21CL Radio.
Happy Monday morning to you, and welcome to the Education Vanguard. I'm your host, Michael Bull, and I want to thank you today for hanging around with us. It's great to have you here, and I want to thank you today for supporting us, because we are on a mission here at the Vanguard, and you may know it already, but we're looking to recognize and share educational leaders. Today, I've got cultural anthropologist Dr. Mimi Ito. At one point in my teaching career, the phrase connected learning meant asking students to work in groups. In fact, I remember being told by my teacher training school that it was the new thing, and I better be sure to talk about how much I love it during job interviews if I ever wanted to get a job. Well, the creation of the magical internet quickly redefined what connected learning is, right? And my guest today focuses her research on that very topic. Dr. Mimi Ito is a cultural anthropologist studying youth and new media practices in the U.S. and Japan. We discuss what connected learning looks like for young people today and how it can impact learning. This is a wide-ranging interview, and it's also an extended one, and as usual, tends to be the ones I learn from the most. Enjoy the conversation. Dr. Mimi Ito, thanks so much for joining me on the program today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, this is fun to talk to you. You're involved in a lot of great things with education and with students. And as a teacher myself, I know I'm going to learn a lot today for sure. And you work with what you call, or what we really probably all call, connected learning. Can you define for us what connected learning really is?
Yeah, sure. So at its core, connected learning is really when a young person is pursuing something that they're genuinely interested in or passionate about, or it's meaningful to them in some way, but they're doing it in a context where they have supportive peers and mentors who share that interest, affinity, identity, and that learning is also tied to some kind of opportunity that helps them find a place in the world. So that can be academic advancement, that can be civic engagement, that can be economic and career opportunity. And so it's a form of learning that we find is both uniquely engaging and important to a young person. And it's also very resilient. And we're not saying that all learning has to be connected learning. I mean, kids need to be able to goof around in their interests without it being tied to academics. And they also need sometimes to learn stuff that they might not be really passionately interested in.
Okay.
But we feel like every kid really deserves to have that experience of connected learning when, you know, it's something they really care about and it's supported and it's tied to opportunity. And the double meaning of connected is both that sense of connection to people and spheres of learning, but also we believe that today's technology also has a role to play in making these kinds of experiences more accessible to young people.
Okay, so if I go up to one of my students and I say, hey, you're really learning something today, this is great, so tell me how this is connected to your place in the world. They're not going to get that, right? Is this something I just need to know as a teacher subtly?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is about really, you know, things that good educators are really doing already. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's often not a frame for it that is within some of the traditional kinds of measures and outcomes and testing that you do within education. So, you know, it's important that, you know, kids are acquiring skills and content and those things that we know as educators, how to identify and measure. But there's also things like, okay, so they learned something in science. Did that learning become meaningful to a project or in their peer network across learning settings? Did it become meaningful for another interest they have in popular culture or something that has status in their peer group? And it's really about seeing those connections across different areas of learning that may be something that educators are doing already but isn't always acknowledged within the learning institutions as a core part of the mission of an educator.
Now, the idea of connected learning to teachers might be a little new, perhaps a little scary because they might not know how to attach to that. So, like, one response I think an educator might give is, well, what's the difference between connected learning and face-to-face connected learning? They're still connecting with people. Isn't that all the same thing anyway?
Absolutely. I mean, connected learning really doesn't require technology. But we do feel that today's network technologies and interactive, you know, visual and other formats just provide a broader palette for us as educators to be able to tailor things to young people's interests and ways of learning, but also to build and support social relationships that are more specialized, that are unique to the interests and also connected to the wider world. So to give a really concrete example, we find that a lot of young people who are interested in, say, some aspect of popular culture or media, or just some specialty, like, certain kinds of fantasy novels or something, they may not have kids or teachers within their local peer group who share that very specific interest, but a teacher can connect them to these online communities and forms of content and fan fiction that really wouldn't have been available to that same young person prior to these more networked forms of online publishing and online communities. So it just enables us as educators to be able to connect young people to resources, whether they're online tutorials or communities and content that are more tailored and that give young people a stage for sharing, getting feedback, and connecting to others who are really close to them, who they feel a sense of connection and affinity to, even if we don't have those resources within our local institution.
Yeah, that would be, you know, one of my questions then. So I teach in the overseas schools and we're just loaded with equipment, right? So we're pretty lucky. And then I'll speak to people who teach in the U.S. and, you know, they might ask me, well, how do I get involved in connected education? I may or may not have all this stuff. What are maybe some of the first steps someone could take to go down that path?
Yeah, I mean, one of the great things about connected learning is it is a model that can be applied to, you know, all interests and specialties, and that we all really have a role to play. But I think one of the challenges is that there's no one size fits all type of solution. So it's really just about being open to the opportunities and interests of that you want to connect with that are specific to your student population. You know, it's not like there's, you know, you can just go to a Udacity MOOC, or there's not a one-stop shop for connected learning. But I think it's really, you know, there are a set of practices that we're focusing on that are kind of things that are maybe not conventional indicators of learning, but ones that are really important to connected learning that might provide a bit of some guideposts for educators who want to take some steps. So, you know, these are our design principles, like, you know, are you connecting the creations, the work that young people are doing to an openly networked environment? So, you know, if you're a writing teacher, that may be about having a blog. It may be about if you're, you know, teaching some other subject like coding, are they connecting to an open community of coders? That, again, it's tailored to that specialty. So openly networked is a principle. Production-centered, we think that most connected learning environments have some aspect of student agency and voice that allows them to create something unique and original. And then finally, the shared purpose piece, which is the work part of a meaningful endeavor that has a purpose within a community or a group of shared interest? And so these are just general guidelines that help orient educators to the kinds of features that connected learning environments exhibit without really dictating the specific tools or platforms or approaches that an educator might take.
So I could see myself in a classroom having a production sort of culture where, let's say, we're producing a magazine, we have a shared purpose to describe our neighborhood. Now you talk about the open network. Do you get, I mean, there's probably resistance then to that concept of sharing that out widely by schools and parents and those things. Do you see that being a big barrier to fully connecting in a connected learning sense? Or do you see those barriers starting to get knocked down now?
I think the issue of sharing in an open space is a really big concern, and it's a valid concern of educators. Mm-hmm. And again, this varies a lot depending on the age group you're dealing with and depending on the content you're dealing with. So, for example, I've worked with educators who are in higher ed even, but are dealing with sensitive topics like feminist studies, for example, where they have to be super careful about what their students share online because they become targets of hate and harassment and so on. So there's some very real issues. Like even when we were doing a photography class, again, there are, you know, just different levels of comfort that both students and educators have about the online sharing. But I think, again, we are developing better both tools for managing issues like privacy or accounts that, you know, will allow a degree of safety and configurability, as well as just best practices for how we manage those things in a way that's safe and enriching for young people. But at the end of the day, I mean, it's real world learning, right? So this is what happens when kids go out into the world outside of the classroom. Things happen. And without, you know, offering some kind of openness to the outside world, it's really not possible for young people to find their place in that world. And in a way, in a lot of ways, doing it in the context of online sharing is a lot safer than doing it in the context of the real world, where real bodies and real faces and identities are much more visible and vulnerable. So I think that risk has to be taken within the broader context of what the opportunities are when young people are allowed to flex their muscles outside in the wider world, and also with an appreciation that even though there's a lot of concerns about the risks of kids putting stuff out online, that, you know, the research really shows that compared to the risks of being in the real physical world, it's much lower.
Yeah, and it's interesting that research supports that. And personally, I would think we really need to do this in schools because otherwise the kids are connected regardless of what we say. Mm-hmm. And then they're doing it at home in the dark spaces of the room, perhaps, or whatever. And if they make a mistake, there's nobody there to guide them.
Absolutely. And I think if young people are able to participate online where they have peers and educators who are guiding them, but also watching their backs, right? So one of the best practices that, you know, our feminist educators have talked about in dealing with these risky topics is that when, you know, things are going to happen. You know, as an educator, you have to be prepared, but you have to respond as soon as they happen. And you have to let your students know that you have their back if they get a nasty comment or so on. And it's part of the important experience of growing up in a network world where young people can recover from bad experiences in the context of a supportive community.
All right, so doing research for our talk today, I read some of your stuff and I came across this, so I'm going to read something to you. Hopefully you'll remember it or you'll think I'm just making it up. But anyway, so you said, all of these high-functioning affinity networks have community values that reward expertise and high standards, as well as moderators and organizers that actively model, enforce, and support these values. So my question, though, is, and I think I know the answer, it's, do you think these communities are created and the structures within it are created organically, or is there an outside group that says, here's the community that we have, come join us?
I think it's a bit of a combination. Okay. So good community management is very intentional, whether it's you know, a 17-year-old managing their own Minecraft server or an educator developing an open connected course, that you know, we have values, we have ideas about how we want our community to operate that are really, really important to guide, you know, the development of a affinity network or online learning community that has positive values and that has learning-oriented interaction. But the reality is that online networks, any group of people, constantly surprise us. So, you know, there's emergent leadership and, you know, there, it's a constant negotiation. So my research team has done case studies of dozens of youth affinity networks ranging from StarCraft players to fans of One Direction writing fiction together to, you know, anime fans, and all of the community organizers will be able to describe their very intentional kinds of approach and values and design principles and experiments they did. But they're also incredibly responsive to how their community is evolving and being shaped. And the one constant is that it's very dynamic.
Well, I got to ask you this then. Do they notice similarities between groups that are fans of One Direction and StarCraft players? And how they organize themselves?
I don't know if the communities would see similarities, but as researchers, we definitely do. So, I think that's part of the, trickery we're trying to do here is to say, look, a lot of these communities that look like they're just kids messing around online and it's very unstructured, they're actually, have some characteristics, like they reward good work, they have specific processes that are about mentorship between more experienced and less experienced participants. There are certain kinds of activities that contribute to a sense of shared purpose that drive achievement and collaboration and engagement. And at a very high level, all of these groups that are really resulting in excellent work and high expertise have common characteristics.
So let's get into what you do in the summers, the Connected Camps that you put together. Tell us a little bit about what Connected Camps are and what you hope to learn or do learn from those camps.
Yeah, Connected Camps is my current passion project that has really come out of, many, many years of doing research on youth affinity groups. And we had been running programs for several years that were really trying to meet young people where they are in their interests, but giving them a bit of a nudge as educators to try to get those young people who might not be really well connected already, who may not have that self-directed drive that a lot of these more really passion-driven or geeky learners have. Our research really showed that there was a ton of opportunity, but you had to be very resourceful and very motivated as a young learner to go really deep into these specialties purely on your own, without adult guidance or without, some more structured kinds of opportunities. And so we were just trying to put a little bit more of structure around it. And we did work with StarCraft and Arduino program and a lot of different areas where we were providing, learning opportunities in areas of youth interest. And the one that really took off last summer was Minecraft, not surprisingly, because it's the most popular game of all time. And it's also amazing. It's just a production and collaboration and community kind of platform. And it has a unique property compared to other MMOs in that you can spin up your own server and basically run your own online community based on the values that you want that community to have. Mm-hmm. So for this summer, we scaled up that effort and we launched a new collaboration with a new benefit corporation, which is Connected Camps, and the Institute of Play, which is a longtime nonprofit focused on games-based learning. And we're running, four servers right now that are virtual online summer camps that are staffed by college students and high school students who are counselors and super expert in Minecraft, who are helping younger kids learn to code and build stuff and collaborate, and also helping parents who are trying to. We have our parent server and a parent camp for parents whose kids are too impatient to spend time with them, teaching them the basics of Minecraft.
Emotional support, yeah.
Yeah, but it's been amazing. I mean, I think for me, this is, just being able to design something from the ground up that is really based on the principles of connected learning, and that's piggybacking on a scaled and very popular platform and game like Minecraft, has been very validating, because all of those features of, shared purpose, of the intergenerational mentorship and interest-driven learning, production-focused, openly networked, all of these are operating in an environment that we really just, designed as for educators to kind of mine the most productive learning aspects of a popular game. And so far, I've just been amazed at what both the counselors and campers have been doing.
And perhaps that's because it's so open, you never know what they can do. And they just, when you give them the tools, they've taken off with it. Would you say that's the case?
Yeah, I think that's the case both with the counselors and the kids. So we started the summer with a fairly intensive training of the counselors where mm-hmm. we were, you know, really training them more on the how to mentor, how to manage disputes, you know, what the what tools they have at their disposal as moderators. But they really went and designed their own challenges and, you know, figured out. A lot of the counselors are in game design programs, so every day, every hour, there's these, you know, new, like the boat racing, you know, this new PvP challenge, you know, this create your floating island build challenge. I mean, I just have no idea where this is coming from. And now we're in the second week of the camp and the kids are designing their own challenges. So it's been really fun to see that.
So what's your view then on when you talk about connected learning and how is it a better or a strong way to learn? And what do you do as a teacher when you've got standards you need to check off as well? Can you reconcile the two and have the two work in parallel together? Is that possible?
I think it is possible for them to work hand in hand. So I think it's a combination. One is that, I think skills and content-based learning can come in as a side effect of kids doing stuff together that's meaningful mm-hmm. and purposeful. It's obviously harder to check off all those boxes when young people have a lot of agency and ownership over what they're doing. So again, it's back to what we were talking about earlier, that the argument is not that connected learning has to encompass all of young people's learning. But there are, especially in areas of specialty and around production-focused skills and so on, that you're going to see a lot of skill development. So that's when you see things working in parallel. So, for example, like coding is a thing, mm-hmm. right, that, you know, is becoming a more central part of the curriculum. Learning coding just for the sake of coding is often really challenging for kids.
Or boring, but yeah.
Yeah. But like at our Minecraft server, you know, we have our coding program, which is really about kids learning, you know, doing programming and typing the commands and everything to get little turtles within Minecraft to build stuff for the community. So the coding is within the context not only of creating something cool, which a lot of coding programs do,
sure.
but creating something cool that adds value to a community you care about. And I think it's that last connection that you just see the skills development and the motivation is just so much higher because there's a place that you're applying the creation. It's not, and there's an audience for it that's more than the one teacher who's going to grade your assignment. And that's where those things ideally are working together. Now, there's going to be subjects and topics that you can't put within that frame, but I think there is an opportunity for a lot of topics to make them, you know, more in the service of a social purpose. And then you'll find it, suddenly the skills development becomes so much easier.
You're a cultural anthropologist. So if you came back and let's say you just fast forwarded 100 years from now, how would you describe our generation, this current generation as a cultural anthropologist? You know, they all be gone or whatever. Let's say 200 years from now. How would you describe them? What's going on here? Or what would you say did go on then?
Yeah, what an interesting question. Well, I think that the thing that is really striking to me about today's generation is that the palette of opportunity for learning has really diversified and exploded so tremendously,
okay.
which means that it's really hard to describe this generation in a singular way. It's sort of the best of times and the worst of times all rolled into one. So it's a period when the kids who are highly motivated, who have very supportive and well-resourced kinds of educational environments, they have superpowers. Like, it's unbelievable, like, what kind of learning opportunity, what opportunity to connect with the wider world a 12-year-old has today versus a generation ago.
Right.
But, you know, but the future is not evenly distributed, right? So that, you know, that a 12-year-old, we're also living in a period of unprecedented inequality in terms of economic and educational access. And so it's also a time when young people who are disconnected, who don't have a broader context and who don't have those social supports, can be distracted from meaningful learning in many more interesting ways than was the case before, you know, when like there were Sunday morning cartoons and that was it. Like, you know, now you can have things on YouTube or a Netflix queue that just can provide endless distractions from schoolwork for the kids who aren't interested.
Is that unconnected learning?
But yeah, I mean, I think for us, connection is really about, you know, intergenerational connection and connection to opportunities. So, you know, it's not that, you know, I have anything against kids watching television or being online, but it's really whether, you know, that content and engagement is helping young people find their place in the world. And that's, you know, unfortunately, there are a lot of kids who are disconnected from that.
So, Dr. Ito, let me take a little turn here. Why did you get involved? I mean, you could have researched something else. Why connected learning? Why did that jump out at you?
Yeah, well, my whole career, I've looked at learning in informal and out-of-school settings. And, you know, when all this technology-based stuff started happening and the internet started exploding, you know, to me, it was always such a ripe environment for, you know, just being an anthropologist and studying new kinds of culture and social forms, but also just a space where I found young people were doing amazing things. I was just so impressed with, you know, the opportunities that kids were taking up. And, you know, most of my early research was on these highly activated, more geek communities. And, you know, what they were able to accomplish with this new capabilities was just super impressive. And then, you know, when I started to think more with my educator hat on, what should we do about this? You know, the question really arose in my mind that why is it only the small minority of kids who are really taking advantage of these opportunities? And I felt that educators and educational institutions had such an important role to play in being sort of positive influences in this networked and digital world rather than the people who were, you know, finger wagging against screen time.
Right.
And that was where we really started arriving at connected learning as a model for saying, you know, here's how educators can productively engage with young people's digital networks and interests.
Well, that can lead me to my final question. Where do you hope things go with your work 10 or more years from now? You've already talked about equality or inequality of access. So what are you looking for to happen in the next, 10, 20 years?
I think the equity issue and, you know, not just from an economic perspective, but also, you know, just for kids with diverse kinds of interests and capacities is really, really front and center for me, because I think that, you know, as I said before, that positive future is already here for the young people who have embraced it. But, you know, the core for making connected learning an experience for all kids, I think really hinges on both public policy and the engagement of educational institutions and adults, you know, in every field and specialty. So really my hope is if people can see the task of education as something that's embraced by everybody, that we all have a role to play, and that it is about, you know, not destroying existing educational structures, but about building connections across them and, you know, in the service of supporting young people's learning, you know, that's, I think, the key to the a more equitable future.
I've been speaking with Dr. Mimi Ito. She is the professor in residence and a MacArthur Foundation chair in digital media and learning at UC Irvine. Dr. Ito, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
This interview was brought to you by 21st Century Learning International. Find us on the web at 21clradio.com.